From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Early July 1947, more than 4,500 Jewish refugees boarded a ship and attempted to run the British blockade of Palestine. The British attacked, the refugees fought back. Tonight on Point, Exodus 47, Inside Out.
I'm Sean Cole, and this is Exodus 47, Inside Out. You might have seen the movie or read the book. In 1958, writer Leon Uris came out with a novel based on the Exodus story called simply Exodus. 2 years later, director Otto Preminger turned it into a Paul Newman vehicle.
Don't you have any respect for human life?
You're late, lady. You're 10 years late. Almost 2 million Jewish children were butchered like animals because nobody wanted them. And nobody wants the ones who survived. Jewish flesh is cheap, lady. It is cheaper than beef. It is cheaper even than herring. You and your respect.
But those versions of the story are so heavily fictionalized that they barely resemble the real story, which is even more dramatic. The backdrop is the same. At the end of World War II, Jewish Holocaust survivors all over Europe were living in what were called displaced persons camps, or DP camps. Most of them wanted to go to Palestine, believing it to be the Holy Land promised to them in biblical prophecy. At that time, Palestine was still controlled by the British, who were only allowing 1,500 Jewish immigrants into the territory a month for fear of an Arab uprising. To get around this quota, a secret Jewish military organization called the Haganah acquired ships and tried to run refugees past the British blockade. The Exodus 1947 was one of those ships. What's amazing about this story is how many ironies it involves. It's a war story that didn't happen during a war. The warring factions had up to then been allies, or rather, one had helped save the other from total extermination. And the heroes of this story were 20-something American guys who had no idea what they were getting into. For the next hour, you're going to hear from three members of that crew. More than anything else, this is their story, told from their perspective.
You know, getting these guys to volunteer and become sailors was a chore and a half. That was part of my job. I would rather try and put three rabbis in two temples than to have to make these guys into a crew.
I just didn't realize at the time, until it happened, that we would really go hand to hand. I'm talking about hand to hand. With British sailors and Marines.
See these scars down the side of my eye? That's from a British club. A few of us in the crew were in pushovers when it came to the British trying to take control of the ship. But let me go back from the very beginning. My name is Nathan Nadler. I was an electrician on the Exodus. Didn't have any electrical experience on a ship, none at all.
My name is Frank Levine. I was an able-bodied seaman on the ship.
I was drafted into the U.S. Army at the very tail end of World War II. I didn't know anything about ships. I was in the infantry.
I learned to sail, and this always draws a chuckle, I learned to sail on the Charles River. And sympathetic Jewish sailors were very difficult to come by. There were guys with much more experience than I had.
The guy you want to interview is Bill Millman, Big Bill.
They called me Big Bill because I was the tallest guy on the boat, and I wouldn't take any crap from anybody.
He is a fighter. Not all of the crew were fighters. Big Bill was a fighter.
Before the Exodus? Well, I was 16 when I was in the Navy. I was 19 when I got on board the Exodus. But it wasn't called the Exodus when I first went aboard. It was the President Warfield, a dilapidated piece of junk that was drowning in the ocean.
So
how did I get on a ship? That's what you're going to ask. How did I get involved with all this? Everybody asks that. I know I know the questions, right? I was stationed in Germany, and I met survivors at a concentration camp. I can speak Yiddish like a greenhorn. I have no American accent when I speak Yiddish. I speak Jewish. I am a Jew. How did I get aboard that?
Six furnaces, each holding three bodies, were used in cremating the dead and often the living. Don't turn away. Look. Burned alive. Horror unbelievable, yet true. The vile inhuman beasts took pride in their concentration camp at Nordhausen. Here, a mere handful
I had experienced overran the area. The concentration camp survivors in Munich for a year. And they told me stories of what they did to our people. It's 55 years later, and I still can't take it. I get very emotional about it. And, well, anyway, I came home, and I want to get back to Germany and continue helping the Jewish survivors.
I had friends that had liberated concentration camps, and the stories they told were horrendous. They were just awful, goddamn stories. And it made an impression, I guess, you know. It was later I found out that the majority of my family in Europe had been wiped out from Lithuania.
Really?
Yeah, it was afterwards that I found out, as I said.
After this whole
business. When the war was over, about six, 8 months after the war was over, I got a phone call at home. The voice at the other end said, "I know you know how to sail, and would you like to help the Jews?"
My first contact was through a friend of mine, whose name was Paul Yaron. And he asked me if I would like to go to Palestine and fight the British, blow up trucks, bridges, things of that nature, and I said he was out of his cotton picking trees. But anyway, we went into Boston, and we signed up in Boston, and next thing I know, I was on my way to New York.
And I was told to report to an address in New York where I was given a physical, and I was introduced to the person that was in charge of the ships that were preparing to carry refugees, Jewish Holocaust survivors and refugees, through the British blockade to Palestine. And sounded all right to me. I mean, I was 20, 21 at the time, and I said, sure.
At that time, there was a group called the American Free League for Palestine. It was an Irgun group. You know what the Irgun was? There was the Haganah, and it was the Irgun.
The Haganah was the fighting arm of the Jewish Agency at the time. Okay, the Jewish Agency was the representative of the Jews in Palestine at that time, and it was a clandestine organization.
The Irgun were the right wingers. I didn't know Irgun from Haganah, Shmaganah. I knew nothing. The only thing I knew is I could speak Yiddish, and I want to join up.
And we went into a company called the Western Trading Company. And we met Captain Ash in there. And Captain Ash was in charge of recruitment. And in an office that could hold no more than five people, we had 20 guys in there. And Captain Ash was short, pudgy, with a gruff voice. And he turned around and he said, "All right, you guys, you're going here, you're going there." And he named names. And he said, "You four guys are going on the President Warfield."
Now, this ship was not meant for ocean travel. It was a flat-bottom Chesapeake Bay ferry boat.
The Warfield was an overnight excursion boat. It had staterooms with bathtubs, showers, beds, mirrors. It had a dance hall. It had a dining room. It had a place to store your automobiles. And that's the type of boat it was. And you would take it at night and travel up the Chesapeake Bay to Norfolk, to Maryland, to Philadelphia. And you brought your girlfriend along. You never brought your wife on these things. You brought your girlfriend.
Is it a sin? Is it a crime? Loving you dear like I do. If it's a crime, then I'm guilty. Guilty of loving you.
Then came World War II.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast. The German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
And the Warfield was commissioned by the U.S. Navy, and they took it across the Atlantic.
And I found out afterwards that it had been overseas. It had acted as a headquarters vessel for the invasion of Normandy.
It was under attack from the Luftwaffe many, many times. The war was over. The Navy had no use for the Warfield, and so they sent it back across the Atlantic to Baltimore.
It had been towed from a scrapyard. It was in very bad condition.
There were no lights, no heat. There was nothing on that boat except a lot of rats.
Needed a lot of work. It needed 3 months' work.
Don't worry. That's their favorite expression. Don't worry, you'll fix it up. Okay, and we started to fix it up.
Why the Warfield became famous, I'll tell you later. On the first attempt to cross the Atlantic, I wasn't aboard it then, she was caught in a storm off Cape Hatteras, and she had to come back. She almost sunk.
And from what I understand, it was probably one of the worst storms that the Atlantic had seen in about 20, 25 years. We almost lost the ship, okay? We almost lost the ship.
But as it turned out, the Warfield, in my opinion, was destined to do something in this world. Nobody knew what. Nobody even thought about it, but it was destined. And we turned the ship around, and we headed back towards Philadelphia. And in Philadelphia, half the crew left.
That's when I came aboard it, in Philadelphia. I had not heard that she almost sunk, but I would have stuck with it anyway, like a lot of the other crew members did.
And after that, we shoved off, went back to sea, and had an uneventful trip till we got to Marseille.
The storm was just the first major hurdle the ship had to clear on its way to Palestine. You need to remember that in 1947, Britain had a lot more sway over its neighboring nations than it does now. And as the Warfield sailed from port to port, it collected animosity wherever it went. I don't want to give away too much about what's going to happen next, but suffice it to say that the Warfield had an uncanny knack for getting out of trouble, and an even better talent for getting into it. Bill Millman told me that when he first laid eyes on the Warfield, he said out loud, "You've got to be brave, stupid, and have a cause to sail that ship across the Atlantic." And you might say the same for almost everything the crew of the Warfield did. Just ahead, the crew learns the plan, as do the British.
I got up on a deckhouse. I jumped him from behind. I grabbed his helmet. His chin strap was under his throat. I was choking him, and the rest of the people, while I was choking him, the rest of the people took him and threw him over the side. Sounds nice, huh? Adventurous? Loved it.
You're listening to Exodus 47, Inside Out, from WBUR in Boston. I'm Sean Cole. I'm Sean Cole, and you're listening to Exodus 47, Inside Out, the story of three American crew members aboard a Jewish refugee ship that helped shape the Middle East as we know it today. The ship's mission was to illegally transport thousands of Holocaust survivors to Palestine. If you're just tuning in, we're basically letting the crew members themselves tell the story, Nat Nadler, Frank Levine, and Big Bill Millman. Big Bill was bosun mate, four ranks down from captain. He was one of the first men aboard the Exodus, so he got to know the rest of the crew's motives pretty well.
One was going to get married. One was going to get a divorce. One was running away from alimony. Another one was running away from the army. I mean, everybody had a different reason to go. And most of the crew that came aboard had no idea of what the purpose of the warfield was going to be. We didn't know we were going to pick up Jews anyplace. And if the guys thought that they knew, they're full of baloney.
After stopping in the Azores and stealing fuel, the British had pressured the Portuguese not to sell them any, the ship found its way to the port of Marseille in the south of France.
And in Marseille, we were on one side of the pier, and on the other side of the pier were two British destroyers watching us intently to see what we were going to do.
So we got out. We ended up in a place called Porto Venere in Italy. This is where we tore out the interior of the ship.
In other words, we took out all the beds, the mirrors, the washstands, the dining room, the dance hall. We took out everything, and we had an empty shell. And we started to build the bunks.
You've seen pictures of the Jews in concentration camps where they slept on racks. We made racks for the Jews to sleep on. And there were about five deep. And if somebody had to urinate during the night, they would pass in a bucket and pass it out. So because the five people couldn't get out, they were stuck there for the night. There was uniformity, a lot of discipline by the Haganah. We were there for about 4 months, converting the ship that normally carried 350 people to carry 5,000 people. Right? Can you imagine this small ferry boat that normally carried 350 people to carry 5,000 people?
And that's when we found out that we were going to run the British blockade. That's why they were putting the bunks in, because we were going to pick up people and run the British blockade. Up until that time, we didn't know.
We were supposed to pick up the people in different ports, but each one of them fell through. Disappointment. Terrible disappointment. We were all depressed. We said, we'll never pick up the people. It'll never happen.
And we head to the port of Sète in France. The port of Sète is a very, very small port. It's not made to handle a ship like ours.
We tied up. It was dusk. Well, let's see what's going to happen. We all thought nothing would happen. But at dawn, what a moving sight that was.
When we get up and looked up on the causeway, there are over 500 trucks and thousands of people walking around. Those are the passengers. Those are the people, the displaced persons.
All these trucks had rendezvoused from all the displaced person camps in Europe, from Czechoslovakia, Poland, Germany, all at the same July 47.
The guys were very subdued, impressed, this was their first contact, or our first contact, with real Holocaust survivors, refugees. Some of the guys even went to the point where they wore white shirts to greet them.
I gotta think of the word here. Pity, sorrow, anger. How can you express something that you know should never have happened, but happened? You got sympathy when you see them come aboard.
They all lined up with their packs on their back and carrying their luggage, wearing overcoats. You know why they were wearing overcoats in the summertime? It's easier to wear it than to carry it.
So the women were wearing four or five dresses. The men were wearing two suits.
And it took us all day to load the ship from morning to night. We loaded 4,554 people. I'll say that one again. 4,554 people.
We loaded them up. We're ready to shove off. We were supposed to have a tugboat and a pilot, and I guess the British got to them.
You were supposed to come aboard at midnight. The pilot does not show up at 12, 12:30, 1, 1:30, 2:30, no pilot. So now the crew sits down, and we're going to do this all by ourselves. Turning engines over. The engines turn over.
And one of the cables wrapped itself around the propeller. We spent hours trying to get the cable off that propeller. We dropped the cable and got out and hit a sandbar.
We're going out, and we hit the dirt. We're stuck in the mud. In front of us is a French police boat ready to arrest us. We got 4,500 people on the boat, a crew of 41, and we're stuck in the mud. Now, if you get stuck in the snow in Massachusetts, how do you get out? We went forward, went backwards, went forward, went backwards, and we went right out into the open sea, and there, waiting to greet us, are the two British destroyers that were in Marseille across from us in the pier. They watched the entire loading of the people on board the Warfield. They watched the entire loading.
I remember I was up for 3 nights. I hadn't slept. I fell asleep. And when I woke up dawn, the ship was in free water. And we started steaming towards Palestine.
On the first day out, we got one destroyer. Second day out, we got another destroyer. We now have 4 destroyers circling us. On the 4th day out, we get a minesweeper and cruiser Ajax.
My God, you see this gigantic warship shadowing you. All right, fine, you're in international waters, but still it makes an impression.
They would turn their loudspeakers to us, and they would say, "Give up, you don't stand a chance." We'd turn our loudspeakers to them and play Sir Edward Elgar's March, Pomp and Circumstance, if you're familiar with it.
They would use their, what they call loud hailers, the bullhorns, and yell across to us that you won't make it. We have doctors, we have food, we have water. But we had all that stuff.
We had 8 doctors on the ship from the refugees and 30 nurses from the refugees. Everything was very well organized to have medical assistance if anything happened.
We had 6 pregnant women. And no woman was to be more than 6 months pregnant.
And we had 2 births on the ship, a day apart. The first birth was successful. The second birth, the mother died in childbirth. And the first mother nursed both the babies. And we had a formal burial at sea. I remember I was crying.
On the fifth day, we changed the name of the warfield to the Exodus.
Gingy, the radio operator, got it from the Haganah in Palestine, and we painted on port and starboard. I got pictures of that. Exodus 1947.
And so we are now the Exodus.
That's when it became the Exodus.
Exodus 47. We were about 2 or 3 days off the coast of Palestine. It took us 7 days to go from Seth, France, to off the coast of Palestine. The plan was to beach the ship near Jaffa.
When you run the boat aground, the 4,500 people were to jump off the boat, mingle with 50,000 Jews on the beach, and disappear into the country.
There was a 5-mile international limit at the time, where if we stay outside of that 5-mile limit, they couldn't touch us. When we got within 25 miles off the coast of Jaffa, the British attacked.
Don't ask me what day. I know the time. 2 o'clock in the morning, we had been working a long time, 24 hours maybe. And I was really beat when, wham, 2 destroyers, 1 on either side, hit us, wacko, trying to get us to stop. The guys on the bridge knew what they were doing. And they outmaneuvered these 2 destroyers and kept on going. And every once in a while, we'd get another crash from a destroyer on either side.
The first attack included searchlights, firecrackers, high-pressure water hoses, drawbridge, and the boarding party comes aboard. I am the helmsman. I'm on the wheelhouse with Bill Bernstein.
There was a big Bill, and there was a little Bill. Little Bill was Bill Bernstein.
Bill and I served on the same watch. And Bill Bernstein, who was maybe 5'7", 160 pounds, picks up a handheld fire extinguisher, and he's fighting these Marines. One of them clubs him on the head. Bill Bernstein passes out.
Clubbed him pretty good. If you've ever seen those clubs there, they're steel-tipped and they have a point at the end of them. You get whacked with one of those things, they can do a lot of damage. I got whacked with one pretty good. I was crazy. There were 2 British sailors armed, clubs, in one of the cabins. And I started schlepping one of these guys out by the arm. And he said to his mate, "Kill him, Harry, kill him." That was me. I was going to get killed, and they started clubbing me. I had blood all. Oh, Christ, I couldn't see. Yeah, I get out of there fast. I wanted to live to tell the story.
Bill Millman and I were on the port side, and he told me that Bernstein, this little second mate, hadn't come out yet. So he says, "Go in and see where Bernstein is." Like a schmuck, I went in. I saw Bernstein being taken care of by 2 women in the captain's cabin. I was confronted by these 2 British Marines, and I started fighting with these 2 British Marines. And before you know it, I was clubbed out. That's where I got these, on my eyebrow. Scars. One of the refugee doctors stitched it up.
Well, Bill Bernstein, Bill and I were very close. I was totally insane. And I picked up one of the Marines.
Bill Millman is about 6'5". You don't f*** with Bill Millman at any time.
And I was all set to throw him overboard when I get shot point blank on the left side of my jaw. And I almost went into the Mediterranean, except I hit the life rail and I fell down and they took me to the sick bay.
And they kept whacking us and clubbing people and they finally started shooting. They had machine guns. They finally started shooting. And at this point, we had lost 2 of the refugees.
We had a 15-year-old kid get shot in the face. And we had a refugee get shot in the kidney. He died. The 15-year-old kid died. And we had about 30 badly wounded. really badly wounded.
And Bill and I are both in this hospital aid station.
Yeah, we end up in the same room in sick bay.
I'm on the lower bunk, and he's on the upper bunk. Both our heads were bandaged, and he could hardly talk. And I remember these words. He said, "Hey, Nadler, we really showed him, didn't we?" And I said, "Yeah, take a look at yourself, you big schmuck."
Bernstein was in a bunk above me, and I was below him, and I could hear him breathing very heavily. That's all I remember. I don't, you know. We had women and children aboard, and the side of the ship had been torn off, and there was a meeting. While this was going on, the powers that be on the ship decided that we would surrender. We fought and held off the British for 4 hours, from 2 to 6 in the morning. We surrendered.
The British had control of the Exodus, and they were taking us into Haifa. All of Jewish Palestine had heard about the fighting at sea, the battle at sea with the British. It was the biggest one of all the blockade runners. This was it. In fact, this was it. We started steaming into Haifa Harbor, if you've ever been there. It's a big harbor. And all of Jewish Palestine started singing HaTikva.
I can sing it.
It's a Jewish national anthem.
I can hum it. La 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 la.
And we started singing HaTikva with them.
La 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 la. It was spontaneous, completely spontaneous.
It sounds pretty.
Yeah, well, it was. It was pretty. La 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 la. I don't know the word for it. I don't know the word for it, but that's the way it was. La 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 la.
Coming up, the reason the Exodus became famous and what Nat, Frank, and Bill make of the whole experience now, half a century later. You're listening to Exodus 47 Inside Out from WBUR in Boston. I'm Sean Cole. This is Exodus 47, Inside Out. I'm Sean Cole. What's happened up to now is that the Haganah ship Exodus 1947 has tried to ferry 4,500 Jewish refugees past the British blockade of Palestine, only to be captured by the British Marines. The crew and the refugees on the Exodus were now prisoners of an ally in a war that had ended 2 years before. As Haifa was still the closest port, the British escorted the ship to Palestine to process the refugees in the very nation where they thought they might find a home. As it turns out, crew members Frank Levine and Nat Nadler have almost the exact same story about that landing in Palestine. You'll hear from Frank first, then Nat.
We very quickly were transferred to prison ships. Supposedly, these prison ships were to take us to Cyprus.
I didn't want to go to Cyprus.
Cyprus was the holding area for anybody that was captured on these refugee ships.
Now, how the f*** can I get off this ship and not go to Cyprus?
Now, it was our understanding that if you were wounded pretty badly, the British would take you to a hospital in Haifa.
And my whole head was bandaged. I got pictures of that. Well, I figured, well, I'll hop on a stretcher.
So I was taken off the ship in a stretcher.
And the British carried me ashore. I got you, you f***s. I didn't say that, of course. You're taking me ashore. What happened? A British medic pulled the bandages off my face.
Looked at my wound.
He said, "You're not serious enough." He threw me off the stretcher. So I walked on this prison ship called the Ocean Vigor.
And that's where I stayed.
Bill Millman, who was steering the Exodus when the British attacked, did end up making it to the hospital with a bullet wound to the face. His buddy, Bill Bernstein, was with him, still unconscious from a blow to the head.
Bernstein and I were in an ambulance heading towards the government hospital. Bernstein was underneath me. On the way to the hospital, Bill Bernstein died in the ambulance. He took his last breath, and I was in the same ambulance. Well, I felt a lot of remorse. Well, I felt real bad, very bad. As a matter of fact, I still do. Well, he had a premonition that he wasn't going to come out of this alive. Yeah, he said that to me, and I said, "Bill, come on, will you? You don't talk like that. You're going to live as long as I am." And I said, "I'm going to be at least 50, so you got that to look forward to."
Meanwhile, Nat and Frank had been herded with the refugees, in fact, the British thought they were refugees, onto the three prison ships that were waiting for them when they arrived.
We were on the ships, the prison ships, on our way to Cyprus. No way.
You know where they took these three British prison ships with 4,500 Jews? We didn't know either. We thought it was just an overnight trip to Cyprus. We started plotting the sun, the Americans, among ourselves. It looks like these bastards are taking us back to Europe.
The British decided they were going to send us back to France, and with the help of the French, force us off the ships. Well, we arrived in France, and the French, bless them at the time, well, bless them, they wouldn't cooperate with the British. They said, "Fine, we'll take these people if they come off on their own free will."
Nobody wanted to come ashore. And for about 2 weeks, these prison ships lay offshore.
I guess the Haganah alerted the press, and they came down en masse. French, German, Italian, American, and newsreels also.
The displaced persons removed from the Exodus, bound for Palestine, refused to land in France, and are sent emergency food rations by French and other relief agencies while their fate is debated. French authorities declined to assist in a forcible debarkation of these displaced persons. Only those in need of medical attention are taken ashore, along with the men wounded in clashes with British boarding parties. This is a struggle.
I was in terrible, terrible pain from the rap on the head. And when I got off the prison ship, they took me in this DP camp outside of Marseille.
About 60 people left the ship. Nobody else got off. And the British said to us, "If you're not off these ships within 24 hours, we're going to send you to Germany." Okay? Couldn't believe that the British would do this. But sure enough, in 24 hours, the anchors came up and we were on our way to Germany. Well, Germany was a cemetery. Germany was a burial ground. Where do you think the Jews were gassed and burnt? And, well, they were gassed and burnt in other places, but Germany was the beginning of it all, the beginning of the Holocaust, beginning of the Shoah.
And when the prison ships got to Hamburg, many of the refugees once again refused to disembark. This time, the British forced them out of the holds with tear gas and clubs and shipped them back to the kinds of camps they'd escaped just a month before. The Jews appeared to have lost, but in the wake of the Exodus affair, world opinion overwhelmingly sided with the refugees, and the British were painted as brutish enforcers.
And that's what really messed up the British. So stupid. They did more damage to themselves with this particular maneuver than we did in any way.
We will proceed the whole call. You all know To vote.
Now, the biggest, most important thing is the United Nations Sandstorm Commission investigating the Palestine problem was in Marseille and was in Haifa.
I don't know whether this was a setup or not, but they were on the pier, Pier of Tears, when the people were transferred from the Exodus to the prison ships. And I guess they were pretty shaken up. They didn't expect to see what they had seen.
Belgium? Yes. Bolivia? Yes. Brazil? Yes. Belarusia? Yes. Canada?
They came back to the General Assembly in New York, and they recommended that Palestine be partitioned and Israel was born.
Uruguay?
You have it now.
Yes. Venezuela? Yes. Yemen? No. Yugoslavia? Abstain.
4, 6, 8, 10. I call
15, 16.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
A good cross-section of Tel Aviv's population is here tonight, about 20,000, jam-packed in Mogilby Square, where loudspeakers have been set up to announce the result of the important vote that's now taking place in New York.
People, I raised two sons, and I helped give birth to the State of Israel. How many people can say that? When I die, I have it already laid out on my tombstone. Was a crew member of the Haganah ship, Exodus 1947.
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Partition passed, 33-13, and is this crowd excited? They're starting their horror dances now, all over the square.
I got a line for you. How many times in one man's lifetime can you help create a country? Okay? We helped create a country where there wasn't one before. If you want to go back to Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, all those gangsters who wanted to form a new country, I put myself in that category.
That was painted by a chap in town here. That's the Exodus. And he isn't a professional painter, but you know what he caught in painting it? Whenever I look at it, I start bawling. He caught the spirit of the Exodus. That's the Exodus.
That's Nat. His eyes well up and he cries.
Do you ever cry when you tell the story?
No. When I mention Bill Bernstein, I automatically choke up. But I don't choke up on the other stuff.
You can't build your whole life around the Exodus. I mean, I'm not a professional Jew.
No, Frank does not live the Exodus over and over and over again.
I'm not going to grab somebody by the lapels and say, well, I'm a hero, man. I'm a hero. Without me, there would be no great state of Israel. That's BS. That's crap.
I don't either. I don't live the Exodus over and over and over again. Nat needs the Exodus. This is no reflection upon. I'm just saying some people need that. Well, I can only the glory of it. You know, I can only think of the Jewish word, which is kovod, which means he needs something to keep him, you know, feeling that he's done something.
I was ready to go on another ship called the Mala, the Mayflower. It was the presidential ship of Teddy Roosevelt. And the Haganah bought it, and I was going to crew on it. And my father died, and I had to get off it. And I went to work as a half-assed electrician, earning 50 cents an hour. And here I am.
I did a job, okay? I did a job. I'm happy with the job I did. And when I go there, I see the results of what I did.
I feel when I get there and I get off the plane and I take a walk and I go through their customs, and if the guy speaks English and they'll say, why are you here? I said, I'm here because I was here in 1947. I was on the Exodus. Now, they do not say Exodus. They say Exodus. And they'll look at me and they'll shake my hand immediately, because we are like the pilgrims when they came here to the States.
The State of Israel, proclamation presented to Nat Nadler in appreciation for the service above and beyond the call of duty.
56 years. And it's not dead. The Exodus is still alive. It burnt, you know, in 1952. Yeah, Welda. Don't forget, it was all wood. They were going to make a museum out of it. So he was welding, and spark caught, bloop, all gone. No, it was tough ship. I told you that ship was in tough shape even when we got it. So it wasn't much better after the Brits got through with it.
Beyond the call of duty. Now, therefore, the State of Israel hereby recognizes the invaluable contribution.
The thing is, it burnt to the waterline, and it sank. If it didn't sink, they would have built the museum there. It would live forever. It would actually live forever.
Gratitude this day of June 2003.
So you just got that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, after so many years.
Yeah.
I must have. How did you feel about that?
As I told you before, proud.
Perhaps you can hear it now. They're starting to sing Hatikva, the Jewish national anthem, way off in a corner of the square, and gradually the Hora dancers are breaking up, and people are taking up the refrain of Hatikva, taking up the refrain of Hatikva, taking up the refrain of Hatikva, taking up the refrain of Hatikva.
You've been listening to a special presentation from On Point. Exodus 47, Inside Out, was produced by Anna Benstead, Sean Cole, and George Hicks. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.